Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. This is just one segment of today's show. You can hear all of our conversations about New York's vibrant cultural scene on demand at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC podcasts are supported by Holy Name Hospital in Teaneck, New Jersey, providing comprehensive centers in cardiovascular services, interventional radiology, and cancer care. More information at www.holyname.org.
This is Soundcheck at 93.9 WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm John Schaefer, and this is Igor Stravinsky's Fanfare for a New Theater. It was played at the opening of the New York State Theater at Lincoln Center back in 1964. Lincoln Center, of course, was one of the first major examples of using the arts as an engine of urban renewal. Since then, dozens of cities have built or are planning to build major arts projects in hopes of improving civic fortunes and polishing their images. Just last week, the New Jersey Performing Arts Center announced plans for a new high-rise development in downtown Newark. But if you build it, will they come? Joining us to talk about the issue is Adrian Ellis, the director of AEA Consulting, an arts advising company in New York and London. Adrian, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Also with us here in our studio is Robin Pogrebin, reporter of the New York Times, who covers the arts and urban development in the New York area. Robin, thank you for coming back today.
Thank you.
Adrian, let me start with you. In your recent article, Can Culture Save Downtown?, you write, The Guggenheim in Bilbao, the Tate Modern in Suffolk, and most recently Disney Hall in downtown Los Angeles have encouraged a rather naive copycat strategy in many cities throughout the world. Why do you suppose city planners are hooking into the arts as an engine for urban renewal?
Well, it may be because in urban renewal, you need large-scale public infrastructure of some sort, and there's not actually that many candidates. There are parks, there are sports stadia, and there are cultural buildings. So if you're trying to create civic space, you end up looking one way or another at cultural facilities fairly rapidly. So I think the reason is it may be failure of imagination. It may be that in some circumstances they genuinely work well. But the candidates for anchor points for downtown, for civic and public spaces, it's not really a terribly long list.
Mm. So when you write that, you know, this is kind of a naive strategy that many cities are employing, why is that? I mean, it seems like, of all the choices that are available, that the arts, culture, that's a pretty good choice to make.
Yes, and I'm not saying that in no circumstances invest in culture for purposes of urban regeneration. I'm saying that you've got to think very carefully about what type of cultural operation you're looking to attract and the scale. I think there's often these days a problem with scale in that in order to create an iconic building that you believe people will jump on airplanes to come to, then you're often building something which is overscaled for the purposes either of the occupants or of the constituency that are there and need to support it. In other words, there is some hiatus or difference between the scale that you're looking at to have a real dramatic, iconic urban impact and the scale that you're looking at to make an operating cultural institution. One pulls you up the way, the other pulls you down the way.
So you also write that culture by itself cannot revitalize a downtown.
I think that's, yeah, I mean, I think that's only takes a moment's thought to be, you know, fairly self-evident. If you look at what happened successfully, I think, in Bilbao and successfully certainly in the South Bank of London where the Tate is, culture, investment in cultural buildings is part of a larger strategy that involves investment in transport infrastructure, involves investment in the urban fabric, involves investment in roads, involves a whole sort of wider investment strategy. Clearly, hanging the whole hook of regeneration on culture alone puts an almost unbearable weight on both culture and the often rather fragile institutions that are at the center of these cultural propositions. So all I'm saying is that if you are going to use culture as a policy instrument or investment in cultural buildings as a policy instrument, make sure it's not the only instrument you're hooking your urban future on.
All right. Adrian Ellis is with us on the phone. Robin Pogrebin here in our studio. And Robin, we have a good example of what Adrian's talking about right across the water, right across the Hudson in Newark, where NJPAC, the New Jersey Performing Arts Center, it opened in 1997. And, you know, was supposed to be exactly this kind of engine that was going to revitalize the downtown area of Newark. Hasn't happened. So, you know, what do you suppose the idea behind this high-rise development is? Is it to kind of goose that? Is it long overdue? Should this have been done at the beginning when NJPAC was first opened?
I think it's a sense of kind of trying to capitalize on their strongest suit, which is NJPAC is considered a success story. So I think the idea is if this place is working somewhat in a vacuum right now, let's kind of create a world around it. Let's exploit it and see if we can kind of extend that success outward into development. I think you do see that at Lincoln Center, for example, you could argue has been a successful model, although in redoing the center now, they're thinking about this kind of super block idea, which Lincoln Center is, where it kind of turns its back on Amsterdam Avenue and doesn't necessarily invite people in. And similarly, at Ground Zero, that kind of super block that the World Trade Center is being rethought so that streets come through and you get a real kind of life on the street. But when New York City Opera was thinking of going downtown, they wanted to make sure the Long Island Railroad would come all the way down there. Just like Adrian says, you need these things in concert. You can't just kind of put up a place and hope everything will grow up around it.
Well, Robin, when you say NJPAC is a success story, do you mean from an artistic point of view?
Yeah, people are coming and it's doing well. And so they're feeling like, let's, you know, kind of try and extend that. I'm not sure you can apply that same success to, you know, apartment buildings. But I think the thought is that maybe it could revitalize, you know, the place on a broader level.
I guess the perennial question is, you know, will the audiences just come, sit through a show, and then leave, or will they stay and inject some currency into the local economy? Will they go to the restaurants and the stores and things like that? There's not a whole lot around NJPAC.
No, it's true. And I think another model in London that's interesting is the Royal National Theatre, where it is its own kind of island of culture across the river. People go there, they use the bookstore, they eat, but everything around it is a wasteland. And it's similar to what they wanted to do with the Jet Stadium on the far west side. They wanted to build that and kept arguing all these apartment buildings and stuff would grow up around it. But if you look at the record of stadiums and stadia and what they do, it's not necessarily borne out.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry.
Adrian, you were talking about scale before, and I suppose the question becomes, what scale is appropriate to each individual city or town? And, you know, a place like Omaha, Nebraska may want to have the next Disney Hall, but may simply not have the infrastructure to support such a thing. Is that am I putting words in your mouth, or is that basically?
No, you're quoting me alluding to stuff I've said very fairly. I mean, I think that there are certain world cities, clearly, you know, Tokyo, London, New York, L.A., where you've got such a dense demographic that almost anything you program intelligently and well will get you an audience. Now, that's a slight exaggeration, but really, you know, even the most arcane tastes can be catered for in a very, very densely packed world city. It's a very different proposition when you're dealing with second and third tier cities. And if they're trying to use the same basic cultural infrastructure of similar scale, then clearly one of the issues will be, what is the impact going to be on existing cultural institutions? Because the amount of philanthropic funding that sort of siphoned out of the community in order to pay for the kit and public funding to pay for the buildings in the first place, and then the really fairly dramatic operating budgets that they need to continue viably, often put surrounding cultural institutions challenge them, to say the least. And so there's a sort of there's a tension, if you like, between the city builders who want the iconic artifacts that will the iconic architecture that will distinguish their city from other cities in an increasingly globalized, homogenized world, on the one hand, and the cultural community that is wondering, what is this going to do for us in terms of our ability to sustain the cultural organizations that we have in this community? And so my fear is that as the building boom continues apace, as you say, in cities like Madison, Dayton, Denver, Omaha, Miami, Dallas, Nashville, that there simply may not be the funding around, not to build them, but to keep them operating once they're open. And then the pressure on other adjacent institutions becomes very high indeed.
Well, and we've already seen in Miami with the Miami Performing Arts Center that its proposed anchor tenant, the Florida Philharmonic, has gone bankrupt and is not there. And so they are left with three brand new halls and not a whole lot of things that are confirmed for presentation in their first season. Robin, you've written recently about the $27 million in grants announced for the Lower Manhattan cultural institutions. And full disclosure, WNYC got $1.5 million for a new performance space, a ground floor performance space in our new digs, to which we hope to move next year. But this grant money, much of it given to, a whole spectrum of organizations, was a lot of it was for building, for infrastructure.
Right. But I think it goes to Adrian's point, which is it's the other side of this coin, which is a lot of these little organizations. It's not the big ones. And it's actually kind of nice to see some money going towards them when really the focus has been on these large cultural institutions for Ground Zero itself, what's going to be there. There were these two museums that were ousted. There's still a performing arts center slated for the site with the Joyce Theater sharing it with the Signature Theater. So here's a time where, it doesn't actually break out to that much money for these organizations. There were 63 that got them, $27 million spread over those. But it does kind of say some kind of vote of confidence for what's already there, these small kind of organizations that grew up in their own way in these neighborhoods, to kind of say, here's a shot in the arm and we want to see you last, and despite the emphasis on these large groups. So, mm-hmm. I think that everybody was sort of heartened by that. And I think there's going to be a lot of kind of shakeout based on what Adrian's saying. I'm constantly getting every day a press release about some new museum or museum addition, and you can't help but wonder, how are these organizations going to sustain themselves? Will people come? Will membership increase? Will donors keep giving?
Well, and the new museum is a good example, the new Museum of Contemporary Art, building a $60 million home for itself on the Bowery.
Right.
They got a pretty big chunk of that $27
million. They got the largest gift. But they, again, have already been there. I think when these are organizations that already have a track record, they already have a constituency. It's very different giving money to those that have on their own proven their kind of capacity than to try and sort of create something anew and plunk it down in the middle of nowhere.
Right.
That's true, but we are in an odd position globally in which at a time when audiences for high culture are either constant or declining, both on the performing and visual arts, we are simultaneously going through one of the great building booms in the history of mankind for cultural institutions. Mm-hmm. And it is this odd dissonance between, as it were, the demand side of the equation and the supply side of the equation, to which I don't think any of us have got, crisp, straightforward answers as to what's going on. But the danger is clearly that 10, 15 years from now, there is a basic mismatch between the sheer volume of large-scale cultural institutions and the appetite for attending the art forms that inhabit them.
All right, Adrian, the whole supply and demand thing, that's a thread of questioning that I want to follow up on in a moment. But first, one of the nice things about opening a new performing arts center is, as we saw with Disney Hall, you get an almost unnatural amount of publicity for it. It's great exposure for the artists, for the organizations behind the Performing Arts Center, and you get sometimes to have pieces written specifically for the opening of a new hall. And here's an example. Aaron Copland, in 1962, wrote this piece, Connotations, for the opening of Avery Fisher Hall.
Thank you.
Some of the music that Aaron Copland wrote for the 1962 opening of Avery Fisher Hall in Lincoln Center. And we are talking about the arts, about culture and performing arts centers as an engine of urban renewal. And we're speaking with Adrian Ellis, the president of AEA Consulting. His recent study, Can Culture Save Downtown, is linked on our website at WNYC.org. And Robin Pogrebin of the New York Times is with me in the studio. She covers the arts and urban development here in the New York area. Robin, Adrian made the point of the disconnect often between supply and demand for what we call the high arts, you know, classical music, classical dance, that sort of thing. Is Lincoln Center, now over 40 years old, is that a success story?
I mean, I think the reviews, the answers would be mixed. I mean, on some level, it absolutely is. It's clearly kind of considered, it's the largest performing arts center in the country, and it's still very well attended, and it's still very prestigious and still attracts the leading artists in those fields. On the other hand, there is constantly a concern there about where their future audiences are going to come from, their aging audiences. And with their redevelopment plan that they're doing for the entire campus, they are trying to make it a place that seems more youthful, seems more accessible. They're doing that in terms of the architecture, but I think also in terms of the programming. When they're redoing Alice Tully Hall, they're making the walls transparent. They're creating a coffee bar. They're creating grassy space for people to hang out in. They don't want it to seem like an ivory tower because clearly that's kind of a dying art form. But I think there is this real concern about, you see subscriptions basically and membership in these places as in a real crisis point where that's not how people take their culture these days. They do it spur of the moment. They might rent a movie. They, you know, might buy a ticket at the last minute. They're not buying, you know, every kind of seasonal series
for the
opera.
They're not mapping out their theater going 6 months in advance.
And that makes it very hand to mouth for these organizations. So it is kind of amazing to see them investing so much in their infrastructure.
Adrian, you've a couple of times used the word iconic to describe these places that that towns would like to have built, so that, you know, it sort of burnishes their metropolitan image, you know, further afield. You know, we may be Dayton, Ohio, but we have this splendid, gleaming new performing arts center, and therefore we're as good as, you know, name a city, Cleveland or Chicago or whatever. I can sort of understand that. What it reminds me of more than anything else is building cathedrals in medieval Europe, where, you know, every town wanted to have its own cathedral because it was kind of a status symbol.
Or I completely agree. Or castles in 18th century Germany, or the chapels at the turn of the last century in the United Kingdom, nonconformist chapels. It could be a sort of it could be like the tulip bubble. I agree, but I think that one of the things that's driving this is absolutely nothing to do with culture per se, but it's to do with architecture, and it's to do with the role of architecture in differentiating increasingly homogenized cities. As capital is more mobile, as the workforce is more mobile, as cultural tourists are more mobile, then clearly cities that are chasing inward investment, tourists, etc., for the money they bring to the city, need somehow to distinguish those cities. And a highly expressive architecture has become one of the principal weapons in that, I think.
Now, you've also written in your study that arts organizations in general are, quote, weakly enfranchised, unquote, in their discussions with politicians, with urban renewal agencies, with architects and planners. What do you mean by weakly enfranchised? And then, I mean, are there examples? Is the World Trade Center site an example of that?
I would say it was a very good example of that. I think that when an arts organization has the possibility of being a player in an urban regeneration scheme, what they are, or urban set of urban regeneration proposals, what they're really thinking is this an opportunity for us to secure funding that we couldn't otherwise secure by ourselves in order to build a home, build or expand our home or whatever else. So they come to the table at some level as supplicants. In other words, they come to the table thinking, is this a context in which we can secure funding from third parties? They are, you know, generally undercapitalized. They're generally not, and there is no reason why they should be, competent players in the game of urban regeneration and negotiating with developers and negotiating with development corporations, etc. So they're sitting at that table thinking, how well behaved do we need to be in order to get this? And that often means, as I say, that they're weakly enfranchised. They're not sitting at the table as an authoritative, empowered voice. They're sitting there I'm exaggerating slightly, but hoping for some crumbs. And the danger is clearly that they end up with a deal which is not necessarily as good to them as the status quo.
All right. Adrian Ellis's study called Can Culture Save Downtown has been linked on our website at the soundcheck page, WNYC.org. Robin Pogrebin of The New York Times, you've been covering the development of the World Trade Center site vis-a-vis the arts for the last several years. What's your take on all this?
Well, I mean, I think an interesting example is the Drawing Center, which was supposed to be on at Ground Zero and was forced out for kind of in the wake of protests that its content was potentially anti-patriotic or unpatriotic, anti-American. And so as a result, they are looking for sites elsewhere and have set their kind of goal on a building at the Fulton Fish Market. And here you have the question of there's kind of nothing there right now. It's the South Street Seaport, which is considered kind of an unsuccessful enterprise. And so is the Drawing Center kind of powerful enough as an institution to bring people there? It's not going to be a place you just happen to stroll by and walk in. It has to become a destination. That's risky. And I think the city, you know, has a role in deciding what kind of terms the Drawing Center would get on that site. And then there's also the question of what's going to happen to the South Street Seaport. Is that going to come back in a way that helps the Drawing Centers, that would make it kind of more of a palatable option? There are all those kinds of questions that are kind of interconnected.
Well, and as Adrian has pointed out, you can't just put a Drawing Center in the middle of, you know,
right,
nothing
on
and
the water.
Expect it. So, but there is some infrastructure there. You've got several subway lines that stop within a couple of blocks of the South Street Seaport.
You do, and they're looking at that. They time the walk from the subway to every site they considered. And there are developers who are kind of like Calatrava's putting up a building, a big architect. There is some interest in the area, but it still would be kind of pioneering.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's always the risk.
Well, Adrian, your AEA consulting does this sort of consulting.
He advised the Drawing Center.
Yeah, the Drawing Center is a client about it.
Oh, okay. Well,
let's be absolutely upfront about that.
Okay. So what pointers do you offer to arts organizations who are either contemplating a role in urban renewal or who are sort of willy-nilly being dragged into that? And here I'm thinking of almost all the arts organizations in New Orleans who suddenly have an amazing burden put upon them.
My sort of bullet points for them would be really think very hard about whether the opportunity, if it's realized, will increase your ability to fulfill your mission as an organization. In other words, don't fall in love with the site, don't fall in love with the building, don't fall in love with the glory of it. Just think, we have a mission. Will this mission be more or less effectively realized if it's completed? Secondly, look at the long-term viability. Don't just look at the capital costs. Look at the operating model that you're going to be in when this building is completed. How much is it going to cost to run? Where is that money coming from? Third, don't always go for the best-case scenario. Everybody in these situations is systemically optimistic. The developer's optimistic. the person trying to entice you there is optimistic about the terms, about rapidity of development. Look at the middle case and the worst case as well as the best case. Always have a plan B in your pocket. In other words, never go to the negotiating table not having a fallback position. And there's a tendency to just go for it and think it's this or nothing. You always got to be able to walk away, and you've always got to know at what point plan A has become so unattractive that actually there's a plan B is more attractive. And just accept, finally, that your agenda and the agenda of the developers overlaps, but they're not identical. You have interests that are different from theirs and that are important to you. They have interests entirely legitimately that are different from yours but are important to them. And just accept that what you're trying to do is discover the contours of the common and the uncommon ground. You're not going to be in a position when you have an identity of interests. You are negotiating from the inception, no matter how sort of nice and polite the negotiations.
Mm-hmm. What we are talking about here really is culture coming from above, you know? It's being planned. It's being placed somewhere. Robin, some of the most thriving arts communities here in New York or anywhere in the world are those that just sort of grew up organically.
Right.
I mean, you know, look across the river in the other direction from Newark, look to Williamsburg, Brooklyn, where,
exactly.
where you know, the rise of all these indie rock bands and the little clubs that support them have turned that area into some of the hottest real estate in the city.
And I think that is always the question. Like, all these jazz clubs, I mean, they clearly was the demand, and that's why they survive, and there are so many of them. Then you have something like Jazz at Lincoln Center come along in the middle of the Time Warner Center, and you wonder, are they going to be able to fill three stages? Is you know, is that going to become a destination for jazz?
And what will that do to the clubs?
And what does it do to the clubs? And I mean, I think all those questions are definitely relevant. And what you do see, which Adrian alluded to, is that for these cultural organizations, it's not just about the art. It's about politics. It's about economics. You have to be savvy. You have to know how to sit at the table and be on the other side and negotiate for yourself.
All right. Well, or you go to Williamsburg like this band did, clap your hands, say yeah, and you become part of a scene that's doing it from the ground up. But we've been talking about the arts from the top down with Adrian Ellis, the president of AEA Consulting. His article is on our website, the Soundcheck page at WNYC.org, and with Robin Pogrebin, reporter of the New York Times, who's been covering the arts beat for a number of years. Robin, good to see you.
You too. Thanks.
And Adrian, thank you for joining us this afternoon as well.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to today's podcast of Soundcheck from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This was just one of the show's segments. You can hear everything we do on demand at WNYC.org. Check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.